Indonesian President Joko Widodo told Australia's Parliament this week to resist the rise of identity politics. But is the President using religion to actually stoke identity politics in his diverse country? Indonesia's population of 260 million includes thousands of different language, ethnic and religious groups. And in an interesting twist, an environmental crisis in the rainforests is bringing many Indonesians together across religious lines. Julia Suryakusuma is one of Indonesia's leading journalists. She's been covering both issues, beginning with Widodo's comments on identity politics.
It's rhetoric, really. His record on democracy and human rights has declined. And in fact, now many activists think that, not just activists, observers think that democracy in Indonesia has at its lowest point in 20 years. This is ironic since when we had the reform era after Suharto stepped down, that was supposed to be the beginning of democratization in Indonesia, but that has opened up a Pandora's box and released all the traditional religious conservatives and mainly the religious groups. Jokowi has sacrificed human rights and what he says xenophobia and intolerance for the sake of political stability.
He spoke out against, and he certainly wasn't the first world leader to do this, identity politics. But how much is Indonesia itself gripped by certain forms of identity politics?
It's very much gripped by identity politics at the moment. I think that Indonesia is a difficult country, you know, with the pluralism, the other side of pluralism, with the other side of our unity in diversity is identity politics, is conflict, it's constant managing of identities, of ethnic and religious identities. But in the present era, it's become manipulated. It's partly to do with the politics, world development and the influence of Wahhabism from Saudi Arabia. For example, just as an indicator, 70% of women wear the jilbab or the hijab. We've become more religious. I feel that there's a collusion between the conservatives and politicians. For example, in the election of the governor of Jakarta, it was very clear that Anies Baswedan benefited from, and he had conservative and radical religious groups rallying behind him. So he became governor on the basis of the religious sentiments, not because of his competence. And then Jokowi has also did not speak out when there was a case of Meliana, this woman in, I think it was in Medan, who complained about the loudspeaker, the mosque loudspeaker, and then she was jailed for blasphemy.
Julia, do you think, though, the very beautiful founding ideology of Indonesia, of Pancasila, which is about tolerance and accommodation, is still intact?
No.
You think that founding philosophy has been destroyed?
Yes, it has. I mean, if you just want a straight answer, then yes, it has been.
And how much pushback is there against the destruction of the Pancasila philosophy?
Actually, a lot of people are resisting against that. For example, just recently I attended a symposium by Nahdlatul Ulama, which is the largest Muslim organization in Indonesia with about 90 million members. The symposium is called Islam Nusantara, which means Islam of the Archipelago. It's an Islam which is inclusive, it's an Islam which is tolerant. And then there's also Muhammadiyah, the second largest Muslim organization in Indonesia, which uses a different term. It's called Progressive Islam, which is also essentially the same. And then you have women who are taking off the hijab because they feel that it's not really Indonesian identity.
One area, Julia, where the spirit of Pancasila may still be alive, though, and you've written about that, is in the environmental movement. We had recently the launch of something called the Interfaith Rainforest Initiative, with the leaders of seven major religions coming together. What was so important about that initiative?
Well, it's a breath of fresh air. because I think that one of the things that we're having to deal with is a religious discord with the permits of churches not being allowed or churches being destroyed or, you know, places of worship of other religions other than Islam being destroyed or not being allowed to be built. It's always good to see this interfaith initiative. I mean, Islam has, there are actually ekopesantren trends in Indonesia. There are the tasawuf Muslims who are more spiritualist. They believe that the earth is sacred and we human beings are part of the earth. So we need to guard it because it's something that comes from God. There are activities like planting trees and organic farming, you know, but how much of that really has an effect?
This coalition brings together Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Catholics, Protestants, followers of Confucianism. They focus specifically on the threat to the rainforests. You've written about this. What is the threat to Indonesia's rainforests, Julia?
Well, the threat actually comes from business. This has been the case since 1960. At the time, 1960, 80% of Indonesia was covered with rainforest. And now, I don't know what the exact figure is, but it's greatly reduced. Indonesia has the greatest deforestation in the world. And this is something that has consequences not just for Indonesia and the livelihood of people in Indonesia and biodiversity, because Indonesia is the third largest rainforest in the world. And it's incredibly diverse, you know, the biodiversity. And it's also the lungs of the world.
It's incredibly beautiful too. I've walked in parts of that rainforest. I wonder whether countries like Australia, though, have been in some way responsible for the destruction of the rainforests. Is there a demand for Indonesian timber, for example, from Western countries?
Oh, yes. Well, of course. In the end, forest management is about business versus the environment. And the reality is that capital always wins. There's the logging industries, there's pulp and paper, palm oil, and there's also the illegal small loggers. The government tends to side with capital. This is not just in relation to rainforests, but also in other areas. For example, there's a cement factory in central Java, which is being built near the Karst Mountains. The people there were protesting, and mainly the women. They actually planted their feet in cement. But in the end, the cement factory, which happened to be a state government owned, was built.
Just finally, how important is it, though, for the growing environmental movement in Indonesia, this interfaith movement that you've written about, to be conscious, though, of questions like poverty? Because something leapt out at me in a column that you wrote recently where you said, yes, small illegal loggers were partly responsible for deforestation, but these tended to be very poor people who had very few
yes.
options.
Yes.
How important is it to, in a sense, reform the economy so that the only option for very poor people is not to knock down virgin rainforest?
One example, and this is something that I wrote about, is the efforts of ASTRI. It's an NGO in Kalimantan. They asked these loggers to give up their chainsaws, and they receive payment with seedlings and manure, and a lot of it is to do with health services. They engage in a method called radical listening, and this needs to be adopted by the religious leaders. They need to listen to the needs and aspirations of the local and indigenous communities to live within and surround rainforests. Initiatives like IRI and also from the government tend to be top-down and they tend to fail. See, for example, the local people, if you ask them, what do you think of orangutan? Why do many of them feel that the government and international NGOs have so far cared more about orangutan than their children? And they say that, oh, orangutan are given milk, whereas our infants have to drink dirty water from the river. And many of their kids die in infancy. So the framing of the save orangutan, save rainforest, or vice versa may not go well with local communities who live under or near the poverty line. So it has to be bottom up.
That's Indonesian journalist Julia Suryakusuma.